My guest today, Gareth Porter, is a historian and investigative journalist specializing in U.S. foreign and military policy. He writes regularly for Interpress Service, and U.S. policy toward Iraq and Iran has been a frequent guest on Takes in the World. He's the author of five books, of which the latest is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, published last year. Welcome once again, Gareth Porter, Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me on.
Yes, I'm really glad to be able to finally catch up with you. You've been doing some traveling lately. Well, since the U.S. invaded Iraq, pushed by the neocons of the Project for New American Century, Israel and its lobby have been focusing on taking out the remaining threat to Israel's hegemony in the Middle East, Iran, and sabotaging the current talks with Iran seems to be just its latest phase. Are they succeeding, or is the jury still out?
I think they're succeeding, but I have to say that they are being assisted in this success by other factors in U.S. Society and politics, which seems to me are sort of partners in crime, if you will, to resolve this this Iranian nuclear issue. And what I'm referring to is the side of the U.S. political system that has generated very, very powerful interests in U.S. Maintaining a dominant hegemonial position in the Middle East, with Iran, of course, as the main obstacle to that. And for a couple of decades or more, I'd say 2 to 3 decades now, U.S. policy has been one of trying to maintain a clear dominance over Iran. And I think the negotiations that we've seen are a part of the pattern that does involve U.S. Maintaining this position of dominance over Iran. I mean, the negotiators themselves, without prompting from the Israelis, I think, leverage over Iran because it gave them this sense of dominance, which, of course, was lost when, you know, the U.S. used to be such a enormously dominant military power worldwide in the Middle East that it could use the threat of attack on Iran as the basis for that. That no longer works, and so now that basis is essentially economic sanctions on Iran. It has been now for the last several years. And I think that this has become the substitute for the lost military threat for the U.S. national security elite to maintain that hegemony. So I simply want to preface my remarks about the Israeli role with that point, that I think that they have another partner in the national security state of the United States, which is generally inclined in that direction. In any case,
well, a number of people have said that the power of the Israel lobby has shown not to be so strong because the U.S. has not gone to war against Iran as they were said to have been pushing for. But I would argue, and want to get your thoughts, that the fact that the sanctions regime, which has largely been pushed by the Israel lobby, and their folks who they had in the Treasury Department, has literally crippled Iran economically, has prevented other countries from doing business with Iran, sanctioning them as well. And this is actually a sign of the lobby's success. What would you say to that?
Well, absolutely it is. I mean, the sanctions were designed initially, sponsored by the Israelis, pushed by the Israelis, designed by their agents of influence in the United States, in Washington, D.C., and pushed by them with regard to the U.S. Congress. Basically, Congress played a passive role in accepting what was put before them. So, you know, it's absolutely undeniable that these sanctions were born in the interests of Israel and transformed into a policy by the incredible power that the Israel lobby wields in Washington, D.C., both through AIPAC and through a set of think tanks, including the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which was the body that actually worked on the detailed design of those sanctions.
Tell us a little more about that Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I know it was formed the day after 9/11 from a defunct Jewish organization called Emmet, but we never hear very much about that, certainly within the alternative media.
Well, I mean, it's a very important institution because they have been extremely active, very aggressive, and very effective in translating the interests of the Israelis into very specific workable proposals that they take to Congress and also shop to the Obama administration. And the administration has not completely accepted everything that they've put forward, but it is a well-documented fact that the administration did, in fact, take an interest in some of the ideas put forward by the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, specifically Mark Dubovitz, who is the executive director, I believe, is the correct terminology for his position, and the one who has been directing the operation of writing up sanctions legislation for Congress and other proposals that relate to sanctions, which he has shopped particularly to the most friendly parts of the executive branch, which are, of course, the Treasury Department, which has been the primary institution within the executive branch that has worked on implementation of sanctions against Iran as well as other parties. And which is well known to be to have within it a very powerful pro-Zionist element. I mean, they have played an extremely large role in the policymaking and implementation by the Treasury Department on sanctions for the last decade.
You know, it's interesting. People have always talked about the power of the oil companies, but when it came to dealing with Saddam in Iraq and when it came to getting Iranian oil, it seems they've had to take a back seat. At one time, Mobil used to run ads on the op-ed page of the New York Times, but it seems like they've given up trying to fight the battle in the press about the right to buy, let's say, Iranian or Iraqi oil when Saddam was in there. I remember the last, Conoco was the last company which had to cancel an agreement with Iran because it was in violation of the sanctions. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, where the oil companies come into this.
I think that's an extremely important point because, the traditional left in the United States continues to be, I think, I would use the term mesmerized by the idea that powerful corporate interests have to be the most important factor in the making of U.S. national security and foreign policy. And so, therefore, the explanation for wars in the Middle East, particularly, of course, in Iraq, is inevitably the insistence on protecting the interests of oil companies and maintaining control over the oil. And I think the history of specifically the Iraq war and its origins simply do not bear that out. In fact, it sharply contradicts it. I've done a little bit of research on this. I haven't gone into it in great depth, but what I do know is that the oil companies preferred to have a deal with Saddam rather than to use military force, for the obvious reason that their interest lay in putting more oil onto the market. And a war in Iraq would simply not do that. It would do the opposite, whereas making a deal with Saddam would be a vehicle for doing that. So, again, I would very strongly argue that you're correct that the oil companies have not been the dominant factor at all. They have been very much in the background of U.S. policy. By background, I mean marginalized in the making of U.S. policy with regard to use of force in the Middle East. And and I think that translates then into U.S. policy toward Iran as well. I don't think the oil companies have played any role in the formulation of U.S. diplomatic policy with regard to the Iran nuclear issue. I think if they had had a role to play, they would have, the policy would have been substantially different.
It's interesting that corporations, oil and other, are really interested in doing business in a stable environment other than the arms manufacturers, but they still make money even when there's no war. But I recall that the National Association of Manufacturers came out against sanctions against Russia, but they were ignored. It was over the Ukraine issue. They took ads out in the New York Times, and nobody paid attention to them. So it's kind of interesting. There are other factors at play.
This is another indicator, I agree, of the true where the power really lies with regard to the aggressive militarist policies of the United States in the Middle East.
In your book, Manufactured Crisis, you talk about how this whole crisis built up. And one interesting character you talk about is John Bolton, who was once described by, when he was U.S. ambassador to the U.N., described by the Israeli ambassador, Dan Gillerman, as the sixth man in the Israeli embassy's office there, or United Nations office.
But there's no doubt that John Bolton was one of the leading figures in the Bush administration who was working hand in glove with the Israeli government. At that point, the Sharon government, at least initially during the Bush administration period, in formulating a strategy for essentially convicting Iran through leaks and other means of having a covert nuclear weapons program in order to establish the political groundwork for what was to be a U.S. Use of military force against Iran to bring about regime change. There's a substantial amount of evidence to support that interpretation. I mean, we don't have a smoking gun with someone close to Bolton or Bolton himself, just blurting out the entire story. But there's enough in his own memoirs. The testimony of Hillary Mann Leverett, who was a National Security Council staff specialist on Persian Gulf during the period 2002-2003, and other documentary evidence to show that Bolton was the key person. He was, of course, both the policymaker on Iran, the top policymaker on Iran within the State Department, within the administration, as well as the person who was in charge of liaison with Israel in the Bush administration. And we know that he took unauthorized trips to Israel in 2003 and 2004, meaning that these trips were not approved by the State Department Middle East Bureau, which was the standard procedure within the State Department, that any trip by an administration official must have the approval of the appropriate regional or other bureau. And that was simply not the case with his trips to Israel. And during those trips, we know that he met on at least one occasion, and I suspect it was more than one occasion, with the head of Mossad, of course, the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Service. And, I think I failed to make the direct connection in my book. I realized that after it was published that I had not put all the data points together. I had not connected them. But it's very clear that within a matter of a few weeks, I believe it's 6 weeks or so, of the June 2003 Bolton trip to Israel, we know from a published source, two journalists who certainly have no anti-Bolton axe to grind or anti-Israeli axe to grind, that the Mossad established a new office during the summer of 2003 which had the mission explicitly to influence world opinion, both through contacts with journalists and contacts with governments, on the Iranian nuclear program. And so that is a very strong clue as to how the mysterious so-called laptop documents were actually created. In my book, I show there are other clues, primarily the provenance of the documents in terms of their being passed on to Western intelligence by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the MEK, the exiled Iranian terrorist organization at that point, which had worked for Saddam Hussein, but in the 1990s was a client of Israel, meaning that it was a client of Mossad. So that's a very powerful link between the critical evidence that was used by the Bush administration, specifically Bolton himself, of course, to advance this strategy of establishing a false intelligence dossier on Iran that would be used as the basis for a justification for war.
I had one experience with the MEK. They were going to one of their demonstrations in Rome about 12 years ago, and it was clear from talking to them that they were a very strange organization. That there was not the kind of sentiment you got. There were protests at various times. I've been in Italy for the Palestinians against the Greek colonels and so on, but these were just a different group of people. Obviously there was something strange about them. I didn't know it at the time what exactly it was. I learned later. One of the things that I found interesting is the way how Israel's nuclear weapons are never mentioned. And I mentioned on my program earlier before I called you, on my last program when I was driving to work 2 weeks ago, I listened to John Hockenberry on The Takeaway, and he was interviewing Walter Pincus, the veteran journalist of The Washington Post, and Pincus described how Israel has done exactly everything that they have accused Iran of doing in hiding their nuclear program from the world and from President Kennedy. And Hockenberry even acknowledged that. And I was going to play a clip from that in my program. It's been scrubbed from the archives. It's no longer on the program.
That unfortunately does not surprise me at all. NPR has a horrible record of expunging from the record anything that would be critical of Israel. There's a long history of that, for sure. And the point that you're making, that Pincus was discussing, merits further discussion for sure. When I was in Israel last year to do research, it was my second trip really to research Israeli policy toward Iran and the nuclear issue. One of the things that I picked up from talking to critics, the people who write in Haaretz, critical of the Likud government, is that there is this mirror imaging phenomenon, which is extremely important in understanding the way in which the Israelis have approached the Iranian issue. On top of their very deliberate deception and sort of dirty tricks, if you will, as best illustrated by the creation of these documents that I mentioned earlier, they also are prone to imagining that the Iranians would do precisely the thing that they did historically in terms of a deception of the United States in particular with regard to their nuclear program. This is a very interesting, I don't want to call it ironical, but sort of a sidelight to the Israeli approach to the Iranian nuclear issue, that in fact a central problem for them is that they can't separate their own recollection of how they deceived the United States and the world from their treatment of the Iranian case.
What's interesting is there's an explanation frequently made why the United States government does not acknowledge Israel's nuclear weapons, that if Israel didn't test, we won't acknowledge the agreement made between Richard Nixon and Golda Meir.
Yes, yes.
But going across some papers of mine the other day, I found in 1989, in October 89, October 25th, October 27th, NBC, Tom Brokaw, with reporter Fred Francis, did an extensive report on Israel testing nuclear weapons for South Africa. In Israel, and it was quite extensive, and I had forgotten, I actually had transcript of these, and I found them looking for something else, so I completely forgotten about this, but obviously this was apartheid South Africa, and that did not raise any hackles within the U.S. Congress about here is Israel giving nuclear weapons to apartheid South Africa. Do you recall anything yourself of any complaints about what Israel was doing in this area?
Well, I mean, I have to be very honest and say that in the 1980s or early 1990s, I was not paying attention to that issue at all. I was involved in something totally different, so my own recollection of that would not be relevant. But I do know, as a researcher now, looking at, going back to the history of the Israeli policy toward Iran, and of course their own policy toward nuclear weapons as well, that they have in fact been very fortunate in getting the cooperation of the U.S. government, and to a great extent, not with absolute secrecy, obviously, but the U.S. News media has cooperated to a great extent in simply not reporting about this, and story after story where it's an obviously relevant fact, it's simply never mentioned. So that is that's definitely a significant part of the political atmosphere in which this issue has been discussed.
My guest today is Graham Porter. We're talking about the situation with Iran and the negotiations. The Wall Street Journal just reported the other day, yesterday, that U.S. officials have said that Israel has been spying, listening in on the negotiations since almost the very beginning. This, of course, should come as no surprise, but they seem to be angry about not that they were listening in, but that they provided the information that they heard to the Republicans. What's your comment on that?
Well, my comment is that it is simply further evidence of the degree to which Israel has penetrated the U.S. political system in a way that is, in my understanding as a historian of U.S. foreign policy, unprecedented. There's never been a situation remotely resembling this present situation, the situation that has been developing really for the last couple of decades since the Clinton administration, in which the Israeli government, through its lobbying arm in Washington, D.C., which operates on the basis of cash through, cash for electoral support for candidates, and threatening to back the opponent of a sitting member of Congress. And that has been so effective that, you find the Israelis capable of essentially mustering overwhelming majorities for one piece of legislation or resolution after another relating to either Israel's own interests or the issue that relates to Iran, any issue that relates to Iran. And in effect, we have a situation where the United States, through the cash nexus, the growing role of money in American politics, in electoral politics, has essentially stripped the United States, the American people, of the ability to control their own destiny in terms of issues that are, of course, of vital interest to the American public. And this should be the single most explosive issue in American politics, and of course it isn't. It's somehow still relegated to a marginal position in American politics for obvious reasons, that the practitioners do not have any interest in discussing it.
Well, yes, we've become spectators. It's going to be Sheldon Adelson and his candidate versus Haim Saban and his candidate, Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
It's a sad situation. I had also mentioned that 313,000 people had signed a petition to the White House calling for the 47 senators who wrote the open letter to Iran to be prosecuted under the Logan Act, and which there's never been a successful prosecution under it at all. But there's never been a situation where so many politicians of the government of the United States have pledged themselves and put themselves in essentially the armed forces of a foreign country.
Right. I mean, the problem there, of course, is, as I pointed out in my last piece, focusing on the letter of the 47 Republicans, is that the issue here is not the issue that's identified in the Logan Act, which is a private citizen or, I mean, it doesn't, I don't think the wording is private citizen, but an individual going to interfere in negotiations between the U.S. government and a foreign government. It's a situation where you have individuals, in this case, of course, members of Congress, who are working, to essentially influence the outcome, meaning to disrupt, to sabotage negotiations between the United States and a foreign government. On behalf of the foreign government. That's going way beyond the Logan Act. It's well beyond the Logan Act. So, I mean, my problem with that effort to sign up so many people, and I obviously recognize that people were doing so because they were responding to the outrage of this letter. But from my point of view, it would have been better if they had saved their energy and their outrage to do something that was much more directly related to the nature of this political crime, if you will. That is to say that these were people who were selling out the interests of the United States for a foreign government.
Well, maybe some citizen's arrest might be in order. I suggest that perhaps John Boehner should be put on a no-fly list because he's going off to Israel in a couple of weeks.
One thing that has
occurred to me, it hasn't been mentioned, but there are some people in Washington are very concerned about the role Iran is playing in pushing back Daesh, the Islamic State, and I also have a hunch that the Israelis are worried about Iran's role in doing that. Of course, it would seem logical if you were just looking at the map why Iran would be interested in helping Iraq against Daesh, against Islamic State. But do you sense some concern that Iran, in fact, is doing the heavy lifting or might be the most influential player in pushing back the Islamic State at this time?
Well, look, there are two sides to this story. On one side, I think you've correctly laid out the broad problem, which is that Iran is the major state within the Middle East regional political system that has an obvious vital interest in the destruction of Daesh and doing its best to push them back from their present. Situation, the present gains. On the other side of the picture is a point that I think that some critics of U.S. policy have failed to register sufficiently, and perhaps I should have done more to write about this myself. And that is that what the Iranians are doing now in their war against Daesh within Iraq is essentially recapitulating the mistake, not mistake, the tremendous wrong that the United States military was committing during the Iraq War, which was to use Shia militia, non-Sunni militia, to fight a Sunni organization. That's a certain recipe for failure, and in fact, it's a recipe for making the situation worse. From all the information, from all the evidence that I've seen, so it is a very complicated situation from that point of view. What to do about Daesh under those circumstances? I mean, it is absolutely true that it cannot succeed without much more fundamental political reform. I mean, that's a weak word, reform, but political change within Iraq that provides for a political atmosphere in which you can begin to encourage the Sunni population to move away from, to separate itself from Daesh. That's absolutely critical. So I just want to register that both of those are you know, major points, major parts of the political conundrum of what to do about Daesh.
Well, we see the problem is spreading across North Africa. We see what's happening in Aden and of course, in Syria. And it's really, there doesn't seem to be any kind of solution, resolution.
Right. And I should, by the way, I should add that at this moment, I mean, Iran and the United States are still sharing that fundamentally incorrect, that fundamentally wrong approach to fighting Daesh in Iraq, which is, that is to say, they're both supporting the use of forces that are primarily it's Shia militia who are in the front lines, and the United States is not opposing that. They're saying that's fine. I mean, they're willing to support it. So it's an interesting situation from that point of view.
Well, we're going to probably be watching that closely, but at a distance, safe distance. I want to get back to the negotiations. The New York Times had an article today that if an agreement to limit Iran's nuclear capability is reached by the deadline, one thing may be missing, an actual written accord signed by the Iranians. It says, over the past few weeks, Iran has increasingly resisted any kind of formal, quote-unquote, framework at this stage in negotiations, preferring a more general statement of understanding followed by a final accord in June, according to Western diplomats. And it says this is going to pose a problem for Washington. What do you, from your position, I mean, you've been closely watching this, what do you think are the chances of the negotiations reaching a successful conclusion?
Well, I'm glad you've asked me that question, partly because that's what I'm writing about.
Right, yes.
And my answer is that I am quite doubtful that they're going to be able to reach an agreement. They're not going to be able to agree on what sort of text, can be issued. And what's so interesting about that New York Times piece that you referred to just now is that the word sanctions and sanctions, the phrase sanctions relief, do not appear anywhere in that article. It's as if, you know, there's only one issue to be negotiated, and that is, you know, how to limit the Iranian nuclear program. And, of course, the United States wants the Iranians to sign a formal text that will reflect the specifics of the concessions the Iranians have already agreed to make if there is a final agreement. That is to say, you know, the number of centrifuges, the limitations or the reduction of the stockpile of low-enriched uranium that they have accumulated, et cetera, et cetera. What the United States is not prepared, of course, at this point to include is the timetable for the lifting of economic sanctions, and that's because the Iranians are making demands which the United States is not prepared to agree to, and vice versa. They are very far away from one another, from all the evidence that I have seen and heard. And so what the United States is trying to do is to use this deadline, this looming deadline, and the argument that, well, if you don't give us a signed agreement, then it's going to go very hard for us in Congress, and Congress is likely to do something that will upset the apple cart. So this is a trap that they have set for the Iranians, hoping that they will relent and agree to a signed text that will make the Obama administration look like heroes and will make Rouhani and his negotiators look like fools and dupes of the United States. That's, of course, not going to happen, but that appears to be what this Obama administration has in mind. And I think it's just a measure of the sort of unreal world universe in which the Obama administration continues to operate in its negotiations with Iran.
Well, the unreality begins with, here is a country that has not launched a war on anybody, that has been sanctioned for years, and other countries that have wanted to trade with it have been sanctioned for years, without any real basis of facts that have been presented. And here you have the charge being led by the one country in the Middle East that everyone knows has nuclear weapons. And we hear them say, well, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, everybody will get nuclear weapons. But everyone knows Israel has them. And so the arrogance to push this on Iran and against the Iranian people is amazing, but no one discusses this.
The only word that I can think of that begins to adequately describe the situation is Orwellian. so that would be my suggestion. And I would invite people to check out. I mean, I didn't have a chance to say this at the outset, but I'm no longer writing for Interpress Service. They, for whatever reason, wouldn't take any more of my articles. Wouldn't pay me for any more articles.
There you go.
That way. So I'm now writing regularly for Middle East Eye, which is based in London. And so I will be doing a piece on the subject that we've just been discussing, the problem that is looming over what kind of agreement to come up with, whether it's an informal understanding or a signed formal text. I will be publishing that, I presume, either tomorrow evening or Friday.
Is that Middle East Eye?
Correct.
EYE. Well, that's good. I'm not familiar with that. I'm glad to see that, and sorry to see you're not going on Interpress, because your articles have been the most informative on Iran. As a matter of fact, you'll be speaking on April 10th in Washington, D.C., the National Press Club, and I'll be there as well. You'll be speaking on the push for war on Iran and from the standpoint of the Israel lobby. And so I'm very—
Right, in that appearance, I will, in fact, take a little bit of a broader approach, I think, at this point. My inclination is to go back a bit more in history and show how Israeli policy toward Iran has always, from the very beginning beginning with Yitzhak Rabin in 1992-93 and going through the first Netanyahu government, has always been primarily using the idea of a threat from Iran to accomplish a whole host of other political, domestic political, and foreign policy objectives. It's never been a straightforward position on the part of the a policy on the part of the Israelis. It's always been essentially a deception.
Well, looking forward to that.
So I think that would be very interesting.
Looking forward to that. Gareth Porter, I want to thank you again for being our guest today on Takes on the World. We've come to the end of another interesting hour. Look forward to seeing you in Washington. Take care.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Bye-bye.